Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 24th of March, these are our main stories. As Russia seeks to blame Ukraine for Friday's concert hall massacre near Moscow, President Zelensky responds angrily. Reports from Gaza say 19 people have been killed while queuing for aid. Israel denies its forces shot at them. And relief for the families of 16 schoolchildren in Nigeria who were freed a fortnight after their abduction. Also in this podcast,
it is the staple food from the poor to the rich. Everyone uses onion.
Why onions are proving to be an important issue in India's elections. Ukraine's president has reacted angrily to Vladimir Putin's claims that Kyiv was involved in a deadly shooting and bomb attack at a concert hall near Moscow on Friday. As we record this podcast, the number of dead stands at 133. Russia says it's arrested all four gunmen who stormed the Crocus City Hall, along with seven other people. In a televised address, Russia's president claimed the gunmen had help from Ukraine and were heading there when captured, despite the Islamic State group saying it carried out the shooting. In the past few hours, Volodymyr Zelensky has responded, saying Moscow is predictably seeking to divert blame.
What happened on Friday in Moscow? It's obvious that both Russian President Vladimir Putin and his gang are trying to shift responsibility onto someone else. They always use the same method. It's already happened. Instead of dealing with his Russian citizens and addressing their concerns, Putin was silent for the whole day, thinking about how to link the events to Ukraine. Everything he does is completely predictable.
Our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, is in Kyiv. I asked her to analyse President Putin's assertion that Ukraine was involved.
Well, he certainly seems to be suggesting very openly that Ukraine was involved, if not entirely responsible, yes. I mean, he has hinted at this being an international terrorism attack. He's talked about a common threat that many countries face. But at the same time, he has talked about the shooting by these men, comparing them to Nazis on occupied territory carrying out punishment attacks, which is the kind of language he always uses when talking about Ukraine, always talking about a neo-Nazi regime in Kyiv. That's Vladimir Putin's language, his narrative about this country. So there is a clear attempt to try to link this in some way to Ukraine. And of course, he has then come right out and said that Ukraine was opening a window on the border to let the terrorists through as they escaped from the scene in Moscow. Now, Ukraine has been absolutely clear that it had nothing to do with the attack and that it certainly says this idea of some kind of window on the border just doesn't stand up to scrutiny. We've heard it described to me by the intelligence directorate here. They've said it's absurd because of one basic thing. That entire border area is a front line. There is active fighting there, and there's a lot of Russian soldiers and security agents. And the idea that some terrorists fleeing a giant attack in Moscow would try to escape by running towards the FSB and to Russian military just sounds completely impossible, crazy, unimaginable. But that is what Vladimir Putin is claiming. And that's why people in Ukraine are worried that they're going to have this pinned on them. And that will mean even further escalation of Russia's war on this country.
And also questions for him and the Russian intelligence services about the fact that a couple of weeks ago, there were warnings from the West, from the US, that extremists could be planning attacks in Russia on large gatherings, including concerts.
Yes, and Vladimir Putin openly rejected that. He dismissed it. He called it blackmail, which is an unusual choice of word. I don't quite know what he meant, but he certainly wasn't giving it any credence, and it certainly wasn't a warning that was passed on to Russian citizens. So American citizens were told by their embassy in Moscow. The British Foreign Office also published a warning saying there was the threat of imminent extremist attacks, and specifically mentioned concerts as one of the possible targets. So Vladimir Putin dismissed that. The foreign ministry also dismissed it. So, yeah, big question. Did that information get passed on to Vladimir Putin and he ignored it? If so, why? I think, you know, there's a lot of questions to answer. But in Russia today, those questions won't even be asked, let alone answered.
Sarah Rainsford in Kyiv. And more witness accounts have been emerging from Friday's terrifying attack. Dave Primov is a photographer who was at the concert. He was in an upstairs balcony when the shooting started. He described his experience to James Kumarasamy.
We come to the concert. We sit at our place waiting 5 or 7 minutes before the start of the concert. We heard the shots. First, I think maybe this is some part of the show. And I asked my colleague who'd been with me, did you listen to it? He said, maybe it's fireworks. But we stay on the balcony. Then we saw how the people at downside going like a river from one side to other side. And after I heard the really shooting, it's the real shooting from the gun. The panic starts at upstairs also.
Did you see the people who were doing the shooting?
I saw the people maybe after 2 or 3 minutes. More shooting, and all people lie on this earth. And in this time, I look to downside, and I saw the flash of shooting, and I saw people with a gun. First, I see one people, and then I saw one more shooting directly to the people, not to the roof, not to the walls.
And what were you doing at the time? Were you lying down, or... You were on the balcony.
Yes, we're lying down, but a lot of people, and we cannot lie all together. In this moment, I'm thinking about now I can die. After some time, next step, to going down from main stairs to the main hall. It's absolutely not safe because the shooting starting from main hall, and we can go down by main stairs, but we need go down because I saw the fire starting inside.
So you had to decide which was the greater risk. Was it more risky to stay and wait for the shooting to stop and maybe get caught up in the fire, or was it safer to leave, get away from the fire and maybe risk getting shot?
First, we try, of course, to open all doors which we can find, but all the doors closed. Then, after some moments, we tried to broke one door with about 7 or 8 big men like me. After that, we find the stairs, technical stairs to down floor. And like this, we find way out to the street or outside.
Photographer Dave Primov, who was in the concert hall when the attack happened. The latest reports out of Gaza say at least 19 people who were queuing for aid have been killed by Israeli forces. The Hamas-run health ministry said they were hit by tank fire and shelling at a roadside distribution point on the outskirts of Gaza City. The Israeli army has denied firing on the crowd. With more details, here's Mike Thompson.
This is the latest in a string of recent incidents where people in Gaza have been killed while awaiting aid. As in previous cases, Israeli forces have denied responsibility for the deaths at a roadside distribution point in Gaza City. Fighting has continued to rage around the city's Al-Shifa hospital, where the army says it's killed a further 20 gunmen. Hamas insists those who died weren't fighters, but injured patients, medical staff or displaced people. An Israeli commander has said the raid on the hospital won't finish until the last militant is in the army's hands, alive or dead.
Well, this came shortly after the UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres visited the main crossing point into Gaza in Egypt, where he once again made an emotional appeal for an immediate ceasefire. Our correspondent Hugo Bashega travelled with the Secretary-General.
On the Egyptian side of the Rafah crossing, convoys carrying basic supplies are waiting to enter Gaza, where the desperation only grows. The UN says more than 1,500 lorries remain in Egypt. Some have been here for weeks. Western countries and charities have blamed Israel for inspections that are slow and arbitrary. They say entire deliveries have been turned away because they included items like medical scissors or sleeping bags that have been banned by the Israeli authorities. Visiting the border, the UN chief Antonio Guterres said Palestinians in Gaza were stuck in a non-stop nightmare.
Here from this crossing, we see the heartbreak and heartlessness of it all. A long line of blocked red relief trucks on one side of the gates, the long shadow of starvation on the other. That is more than tragic. It is a moral outrage.
His visit happened just days after a UN-backed report said half of Gaza's population of 2.2 million people faced catastrophic levels of hunger. Speaking to the BBC, Mr. Guterres urged Israel to lift the obstacles to the delivery of aid.
Do you think these obstacles are intentional?
It is obvious that these obstacles are part of the way the war is being conducted in relation to Gaza.
The Israeli government rejects the criticism and says the UN has failed to distribute aid inside Gaza.
Hugo Bashega on the Egyptian side of the Rafah border crossing into Gaza. Now, some good news out of Nigeria, where the authorities say 16 children and a woman who were kidnapped from a school in the northwest of the country a fortnight ago have been rescued. They were taken 2 days after nearly 300 students and staff were abducted from a school in Kaduna State. Mass kidnappings have been a constant problem across northern Nigeria since the abduction of schoolgirls from Chibok a decade ago, which sparked an international campaign for their return. With more details about these latest kidnappings, here's our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
The governor of Sokoto State, Ahmed Aliyu, said the freed hostages were all in good health. He said the students had been reunited with their families.
I'm really overwhelmed, being that all the abducted children were rescued and hurt. This is indeed a commendable effort.
We're told the army was involved in the rescue operation. What we don't know is whether any ransom was handed over. A senior military commander has promised that people in Sokoto State will now be free from the kidnapping gangs. But in recent years, it's become clear that this is a lucrative business and will be hard to stop. The raid on Tsangaya School happened just 2 days after almost 300 students and staff were seized in Kaduna State. They're all still missing.
Will Ross. Hong Kong's new national security law came into force on Saturday, putting into immediate effect tough penalties of up to life imprisonment for crimes including treason and insurrection. The territory's pro-Beijing chief executive, John Lee, had called for the law, commonly referred to as Article 23, to be rushed through. And it was, with little debate. Mr. Lee and the authorities in mainland China say it's a necessary safeguard against troublemakers, but it's been strongly criticised by Western countries and Japan for further damaging the rights and freedoms of Hong Kongers. Carmen Lau is a former elected district councillor in Hong Kong. She's now a human rights activist based in the UK.
The causes are arbitrary, is really vague and broad that even layman citizen would have a chance to break the law. For example, there are a few causes regarding state secrets and also treasons. All of the interaction with, they say, foreign forces are being regarded as breaking the law. Simply, for example, just maybe communicating with the outside world would have been a chance to break the law if someone's reported to the authorities. Communications with foreign media may also be regarded as having connections with foreign forces. This Article 23 creates a even worse chilling effects to Hong Kongers, because since 2020, Hong Kongers inside Hong Kong are either being silent or already being jailed. The law has just been passed for a few days, but I've already seen some of my friends, they've deactivated their accounts on social media, even their in fake names.
Human rights activist Carmen Lau. The renowned Italian pianist Maurizio Pollini has died at the age of 82. Born in Milan, he had an international career that spanned more than six decades. Judy Frankel looks back at his life.
Maurizio Pollini began playing the piano at five and gave his first recital in Milan at 11. In 1960, when he was just 18 years old, he entered the Warsaw Chopin International Competition and wowed the judges. In an interview with the BBC in 2017, he explained his love of Chopin.
I think to be considered a Chopin player is a compliment. I take it absolutely as a compliment. His composition, Sounds of the Piano, perhaps in a more beautiful way than any other composer is possible. This is a touch of magic, certainly by Chopin.
But his repertoire was wide. As well as Chopin and composers such as Beethoven and Schumann, he also played 20th century and more contemporary music, including Stravinsky and Stockhausen. Known for his intellectual rigour, he was among those rare artists to whom other musicians paid close attention. And he was a master of the keyboard, able to play the most difficult music with barely a wrong note. But some critics found his interpretations came more from the head than the heart. He was interested in chess and politics. He was a member of the Italian Communist Party for a while and a vocal critic of Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. But as he told the BBC, it was music above all that got him up every morning.
I couldn't live without the music. So every day I think is an enormous luck that I can sit on the piano and practice, because I have a relation with a wonderful piece of music. This is an incredible luck that we have. This is something absolutely special.
His death was announced by La Scala Opera House in Milan, where he performed nearly 170 times and where he will lie in state until his funeral.
Judy Frankel on the life of the Italian pianist Maurizio Pollini. Still to come on this edition of the Global News Podcast.
Every single line in that song has some sort of grammatical or language error.
We meet the man who was so annoyed by grammatical mistakes, he decided to make a musical full of them.
Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being. I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaul.
And we're on a quest to find out where in the world women are living their best lives.
We're hearing from some incredible women about what their countries are getting right.
And picking the best bits for our female fantasy land. Because you can't build it if you can't imagine it first. Where to Be a Woman from the BBC World Service.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. It's not often that a humble vegetable becomes an issue in national elections, but that's what's happening in India with onions. India is the world's largest exporter of onions. The authorities in Delhi have just announced an indefinite extension of a ban on those exports, a move that's likely to increase prices in some overseas markets. So, have onions become a political hot potato in India? Our South Asia correspondent Ambrasan Etirajan told us more.
Well, what traders would see this as a political move because, economically speaking, the prices have come down by 50% since last November when the government was discussing about imposing a ban on exports. And it will be a huge loss even for onion growers because many people started growing onions, especially in the state of Maharashtra, hoping that the government will lift the ban. Now, you mentioned humble, but this humble onion can also changed governments, particularly in India, because the prices went up to nearly $1.5 last year, triggering concerns. So the Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government doesn't want to take any chance because the elections are only a few weeks away. In case of any increase in the prices of onion, because it is the staple food from the poor to the rich, everyone uses onion, whether it is a biryani or even some parts of India where people will eat flat bread with just onion because they can't afford to buy other vegetables. So onion is a very key player, especially in the run-up to the elections.
For Indians, onions are like pasta for Italians or cheese for the French.
Yes, indeed. And if you talk about any dish, whether in India or in Bangladesh or in Pakistan, you cannot start your cooking without putting some onions on the table first. And as I mentioned, like some people just eat raw onion with the chapati or the Indian-made bread. The impact it is having is on other countries, because many people, like in Nepal, for example, they fully depend on Indian onion imports. And all of a sudden, if India stops, that is having a huge impact on the local market and local produce in Bangladesh, in Malaysia, in the UAE. So they all want India to follow a certain type of consistent policy. They don't want India to keep changing their mind so that they can have a consistent supply of onions so that they will not have any impact, they will not have any problem among their own public.
Ambrosan Etirajan. In Australia, new rules have come into force that aim to reduce the intake of foreign students. They're part of a plan to bring down the number of migrant arrivals, a topic that's become an important political issue as many Australians complain of a housing crisis. Mickey Bristow reports.
Foreign students arriving in Australia will have to pass a tougher English test. There'll also be more checks to ensure student visas aren't being used by people who simply want to work. The rules were relaxed at the end of the pandemic to allow in more migrants to fill vacant jobs as the economy rebounded. But immigration in Australia is now at a record high, a net intake of more than 500,000 people last year. This is putting pressure on the housing market and has led to calls for restrictions.
Mickey Bristow. Bad grammar is a thing up with which many people will not put. A sentence which proves getting it right grammatically doesn't necessarily make for easy understanding or speaking. That said, people do get quite hot under the collar about grammatical mistakes. But even the most pedantic member of the grammar police probably hasn't been so annoyed by poor use of language that they felt the urge to create a musical on the subject. That's where Jeffrey Berg comes in. Here's a taster from his musical.
It's the comma for the end in red, white and blue. It forces you to pause where you wouldn't have to.
The Angry Grammarian has just ended a sold-out run in Philadelphia. Jeffrey Berg spoke to Julian Warwicker.
Back in the 2000s, mid-2000s, I started writing a column about grammar for a paper in Philadelphia where I live. And it was inspired by, honestly, reading Lynn Truss's Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. I had read that this book had come out. It was before it was even out in the States. And I said, you know what, this is a book that I absolutely need to read. So I went on Amazon UK and got a copy shipped to the States. And a few years later, I decided that, you know what, I would love to write a column about grammar. And so I started doing that and it developed a following. And in the meantime, I was always a fan of musical theater and started just writing some grammatical parodies on my own. They weren't very good, but I enjoyed them. I had a good time with them. And was talking with a friend one day and he said, hey, do you think The Angry Grammarian, which was also the name of the column, he said, do you think The Angry Grammarian could be a musical? And I thought about those musical parodies that I've written. I said, you know what? Yeah, I think it could. Just like write a story around it. And yeah, we could be off to the races for that.
It isn't just anyone can end a sentence spin word at.
If you're an angry grammarian, what makes you angry?
What makes me angry? You know, I get angry when folks, they don't use language correctly, but also when they're too precious about language. I think that there's a middle ground that one should take. Things like the rule that says you can't end a sentence with a preposition or you can't split an infinitive. You know, these are things that we all learned in school growing up. And I would just say, why? Why can't you do that? The answer that folks would give is that is the rule. And it became a rule because you can't do it in Latin. but that's a really dumb reason for a rule about English.
Give us an example of some of the music. I mean, I listened to a small portion of a song from the musical before we spoke called Whom Cares?
Every single line in that song has some sort of grammatical or language error. And I have to tell you, that was actually probably the hardest song in the show to write. First, to just assemble a catalogue of that many errors and then make them rhyme.
Jeffrey Berg speaking to Julian Warwicker. 4 months ahead of the Olympic Games, the city of Paris is renewing another old sporting tradition, the annual race of cafe waiters. The aim? To find the fastest waiter to carry a breakfast tray over a distance without any spillage. The race was abandoned several years ago, but now it's been revived, as Hugh Schofield explains.
Today there are waiters' races in cities across the globe, but it's generally accepted that they're all pale imitations of the original, which was started here in Paris just before the First World War. And this morning, once again, more than 200 waiters and waitresses will be competing over a 2-kilometre course through the historic Marais Quarter. They'll be dressed formally in white top and apron, and on each tray will be posed a croissant, a cup of coffee and a glass of tap water. Only fast walking, not running, is allowed, and judges at the end will be checking the amount of liquid that has spilled. Not quite an Olympic sport, but there is a link. Ahead of the July Games, the city wants to show off the footwork, the energy, and the fine balancing skills that have helped make its bistros and brasseries so famous around the world.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. And if you think that's hard, spare a thought for Scottish runner Jasmine Paris. Despite her name, she's not been racing in the French capital, but in one of the world's hardest ultra marathons, becoming the first woman to complete the grueling 160-kilometre course, that's 100 miles, in the US state of Tennessee, just inside the allotted 60 hours. Only 20 men have managed the same feat. Simon Jones reports on the 40-year-old vet's remarkable achievement.
As Jasmine Paris completed the course with just 99 seconds to spare, she slumped to the ground, her legs scratched from days of running through thick woodland and complete exhaustion etched on her face. Known as the race that eats its young, the Barclay Marathons involve running up and down the equivalent of 60,000 feet, about twice the height of Mount Everest, in extreme heat. The race is also known for its odd traditions. It's inspired by a famous prison escape. It begins when the race director lights a cigarette, and the course is unmarked, so competitors have to memorise the route. Jasmine Paris can't currently speak because she did so much heavy breathing over the 100 miles, but in a statement she said although her body had been screaming at her to stop, she was overjoyed with her achievement.
Simon Jones, and you can see photos and read more about Jasmine's story on the BBC News website. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting. The producer was Sean Wales. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.